that he's off track. And today I asked the question, how then does the older brother ever figure out that he's off track? How is it that the older brother could ever come to the point where the younger brother in the story of Luke 15 says, I'm lost, I'm prodigal? Both sons are pursuing methods of personal fulfillment apart from relationship to the Father. It's just that the one who's right there on the farm has a whole lot more of a difficult time seeing that he is out of relationship with the Father than the younger one. So what are the signs of being an older brother type? With me? What are the signs? Look with me in verse 28 of the story. When we really first get to know the older brother, the first thing we find out about him in verse 28 was that the older brother, when he hears about the party, when he hears about the younger brother coming home and the fatted calf, the older brother became what? The older brother became angry. The first sign that you're an older brother is that when life doesn't go as you would like it, you don't get sad, you get mad. You don't get sad with disappointments, you get mad at disappointments. The elder brothers, you see, believe that if they live life the right way, they ought to get a good life. I mean, they're living a good life so that they can get a... That's right. I mean, they study hard in school, not because they want to be a good person. They study hard in school, not because they revel in the wonders of creation. They study hard in school, not because they're naturally curious and they want to orient themselves to the truth. They study hard in school so that they can get a scholarship. They keep their nose clean in college because they want a decent job. They bring flowers to their wife because they want something. They are nice to their boss because they want something. And what happens when they don't get the raise, when they don't get the promotion? The same thing that those who were hired hands in the heat of the day in Jesus' parable. That's what happens. They get mad because someone else got the promotion that they wanted, and they get mad because they think they deserved it more than the other. I've been working here twice as long as she has. I've been giving everything to this company, and they chose. And so when they don't get what they want, they are not just disappointed, they're angry because they have been doing what they are doing in order not to be in relationship, but to get what they want. You see? And so their response to pain and their response to somebody else's pain is not compassion. It's immediately an inquisition into who is to blame. They're not sad, they're bitter. They're not thankful. They feel cheated when it doesn't work out that way. And their first solution always is to ask, who do I blame? Whose fault is it? If something didn't go right, it's because they weren't doing it as well as I was doing it. And if they would do it as well as I'm doing it, it wouldn't have happened. Something not right, whose fault is it? These are all signs of the older brother syndrome. Are you with me? Is that familiar to anybody? I won't ask for a show of elder brother hands. Okay. Second sign of elder brother lostness is again in verse 28, And he refused to go in. He can't have a good time. He can't go have a party because he's too disturbed by the injustice of it all. There is this sense of superiority. This sense of superiority. There's anger, and there is a kind of a standoffish superiority. Elder brothers say things like this. Well, I know I've got a lot of problems, but at least I don't. You ever heard that one? But at least I don't. Or they say this. I just can't understand how anybody could ever do that. How could anybody ever be so perverted as to do that? They say, I would never. And that's because they think they're richer or smarter, or they're of a better race, or they're of a better class, or they're religiously right, or whatever. They're the kind of person that asks somebody at the seminar, don't you believe that we go to church here because we're righter than other churches? And if somebody has the guts to say, you know, I think we have our strengths, but we've got our weaknesses about like everybody else. And the question comes back, the elder brother question is, well, if we're not righter than everybody else, why do you come to church here? And the answer, of course, is, well, somebody loved me, and these people around here need more love than anybody I know. And the elder brother will be offended at that answer. You see, the scandal of the cross is that we choose a church based on how much the people need love, not on, am I the rightest? That's the scandal of the cross. It's deeply offensive to the elder brother because he's not dealing with a relationship with a lavishly gracious God. That's not what it's about. It's about being right and having one's life set right in more comfortable kinds of ways. And that's the agenda. The older brother type, when he's told he's wrong, becomes defensive. He's like the woman who marries an alcoholic, and she thinks that she can control him. And she gets her sense of esteem by rescuing some addict. And then when he's sober, she reminds him of how much she's rescued him and how much he owes her, right? And when the poor drunk gets sober, she doesn't know what to do with herself. Her whole mission in life is gone. And I think in some ways that's what's happening here with the older brother. When he sees the younger brother finally come home to his senses, all of this talk to Dad, well, at least, Dad, I didn't go squander one third of the inheritance with prostitutes. That kind of talk is now done. And so he's mad, and he won't join the party. Won't join the party at all. You remember the story, if you've begun reading the book, Tim Keller cites a story by Eliot in which all the disciples are gathered around Jesus, and Jesus tells them all, I would like for you to carry a rock for me. And Peter, being the good, efficient kind of agenda-driven, performance-driven person that he is, he picks up a pebble and sticks it in his pocket, right? You with me on this story? And all the other disciples grab rocks and they carry it. And about lunchtime, they get to a place, they sit down, and Jesus, in this apocryphal make-believe story, turns all the rocks into lunch. And Peter, of course, gets a communion cracker, and everybody else gets a meal. And so Peter thinks, oh, I've got the idea. I know what Jesus is after now, right? He's trying to teach me if I want a great reward, I need to get a big rock. And so after lunch, he goes and he finds him a boulder about, you know, yay big that he can barely carry, and strains all afternoon, already famished because of such a little bitty lunch. And he carries that, and Jesus comes about supper time, and he comes to the stream and says, now, boys, I just want you to throw that rock into the water for me. And they all do. And Peter looks at Jesus in this story, and he says, what's up, man? I can't win for losing. And Jesus says, you didn't hear what I asked. I asked you to carry a rock, not for you, but for me. The older brother is just like the younger brother, living his own life for his own reasons. He's just using obedience to mask that fact. So this sense of superiority, this sense of anger is a symptom of what's going on. And it's going on that way because he doesn't recognize that this is still a self-advancement kind of agenda. It's still an agenda that says, my identity only works if I can differentiate myself from others, if I can advance myself in some way. Third sign of elder brother lostness, Keller suggests, is a fear-based compliance. A fear-based compliance. And he finds in verse 29 this phrase, all these years I've been slaving for you. I was watching some news on the internet lately, and there's this lady who's given a bunch of dating advice. And I confess, I'm drawn to that stuff sometimes, and so I click on it, and there she is. She's on one of these shows on ABC. I don't know what her name is. Okay, Denise, you can yank my man credentials if that's what you must do. But anyway, I click on this, and she is letting the girls have it. And she says, ladies, if you're not going to be honest with your man, you may as well just call it quits, right? Because you're not going to get what you want out of this relationship if you're not honest. And I'm going, duh. But the advice, you see, is still about getting what you want out of your relationship, right? And honesty is a tool with which you can try to get what you want. Yes? I mean, the younger brother says, lie, steal, cheat, doesn't matter, as long as you get what you want. The older brother says, no, the best way to get what you want is to tell the truth. But they are both trying to get what they want. Yes, you get it? That's the reason they're both prodigal sons. It's just that the older one doesn't get it. He hadn't figured it out yet. He hadn't figured out how selfish he is yet. Be honest, because it's good for business. Because if you get caught lying, it's bad for business, you see? And when your employees believe you're honest with them, they'll work hard. And so that's good for business. And that is really the ethics course taught at one of the major universities in this country, in business ethics. It's an effective long-term form of selfishness. And this contributes to fear of exposure, fear that the real motivations of the heart will be exposed. All these Hollywood fake relationships will be exposed. I love Keller's illustration of the man who gave his king his prize carrot. Did you get this far in the book, any of you? He's got this prize carrot, the gardener. He's just so proud of it. I mean, all of a sudden, after 30 years of gardening, he comes up with this carrot that's like this, you know, and he says, I want to give this to the king. And so he takes his prize carrot and just presents it before the king. And the king is so impressed. He says, man, if you're a gardener of that caliber, I want to give you a plot of ground near yours of mine, and I want you to garden it for me, okay? Here's a farm. Take care of it. Man, what a great carrot grower. And that he would give his prize carrot of his lifetime to me, I'm just so deeply honored. Huh? The noble guy who is also the horse trainer watches this. And so he goes into his several stalls and he picks out the finest stallion the next day. And he says, if he gets a farm for a carrot, what can I get out of this great-looking stallion? So the next day he goes and he gives the king his beautiful, black, wonderful stallion. Just an amazing piece of horse flesh. And the king says, thank you very much. Good day. And the man looks dumbfounded again. And the king says, you know, the fellow who gave me the carrot, but you're trying to give yourself the horse. In a world that sees this kind of stuff, we need to be very clear about why it is Christians do what they do. They don't do good works to get saved. They do good works because they're in love with the King who has saved them. Fear-based compliance. Fear of losing business, so we do what's right. Fear of being exposed, so we do what's right. Fear of other people not following us, and for there being all kinds of conflict, and that's the reason we do what we do. Y'all know the slippery slope argument? A slippery slope argument is very characteristic of elder brothers. And the slippery slope argument goes like this. Well, I don't have anything against drinking coffee with neighbors, but I'm afraid that drinking coffee with neighbors will lead to drinking whiskey with neighbors, and so we probably ought not to do that, and so we're not going to drink coffee with neighbors because it's a slippery slope. Once you drink coffee with neighbors, pretty soon you know what people are going to be doing. They're going to be drinking whiskey with them, right? It's a slippery slope. You go down this path a little ways, and pretty soon you won't be able to stand on the slope. It will be slippery, and you just slide off down the deep end, right? And so this kind of argument often gets made. It's kind of ethical specialty of elder brothers. My Uncle Cletus, a long time ago, when he caught fire for the Lord about 70 years ago, went up to the elders of his local congregation, and I think I've told this story once or twice before, but he says, Elder so-and-so, what can I do to help people get in here so they can hear the gospel? And the elder looked him straight in the face, and he said, son, we don't want too many of them. Too many of them's too hard to handle. Too many of them's too hard to handle. Small old elder brother congregations often have leaderships like this that cling to rigid forms of social control that do the bidding of a couple of interrelated but conflicted clans. Nothing gets done because doing new things means that people usually can't agree on the new stuff. And so they cling to these little rigid rules so that nothing can happen to create a disturbance in the little detente that the families have. Yes? And the rigid black and white lines on the paint by number set is all that they can see in the Bible. They're scared to death. They're scared to death of a blank canvas where someone by the Spirit of God in relationship with Christ would try to do good and paint an artistic kind of life. No, they've got a paint by number set because the families can agree on the picture that it's going to happen ahead of time. One minister recently told me that his church didn't want to risk internal dissension. Listen, didn't want to risk a church fight and trying to do something new for kids, he said. There weren't that many kids around anyway. And my friend just took his parishioner to the office of the church, the preacher's office, and pointed to a whole playground full of kids just across the way. It's this kind of social dynamic that Jesus described as straining at gnats and swallowing camels. Hear it? Gnats and camels are unclean animals. And if you eat a gnat, you've defiled yourself by eating an unclean animal, right? And so they would try to strain gnats so that they didn't defile themselves with that unclean animal. But at the same time, Jesus says they're willing to swallow camels. And when we get so focused on the teeny tiny rules that exist so that we will not ever have any kind of discussion, not ever have any kind of conflict, and we cherish the teeny tiny rules that prevent us from ever having any conflict, what happens is we lose sight of all the kids on the school ground just across the way, and we end up swallowing a camel of neglecting a whole generation of people around about us while we're focused on stringing gnats. These are symptoms of elder brotherhood. Rules are cherished because they keep disagreements from surfacing. Rules keep us from noticing the camels that we're swallowing. And fourth and lastly today, I would say that the sign of elder brotherhood, a sign of elder brotherhood, is that we're just insecure about the Father's love. The elder brother says, "You never gave me a party. Don't you love me? You never gave me a party. Why didn't you give me a party?" We can see this insecurity in people when they respond to criticism as if it were some kind of affront against their dignity as an individual. Criticism is not something like, "Hey, you could really do better if you do it this way." I mean, the person who knows he's deeply loved and affirmed and supported, when he hears criticism, well, you know, "I really have blown it." They kind of feel bad, but they look forward to the opportunity to do better. The person who doesn't know they're loved, when they hear that criticism, it will be devastating to them. And they will pretend like they're right all the time. They'll have unresolved guilt. They'll feel guilty about things. They'll keep secrets to themselves. They'll never say, "I have this struggle," because the guilt is unresolved and unresolvable because they really doubt whether God could ever actually love somebody that had that addiction, that had that kind of motivation. You end up beating yourself up because that's the only thing you can do. At least you can control that, and so you beat yourself up over your failures. Your prayer life is pretty anemic because prayer has always been about getting what you want rather than loving the God who loves you. I mean, he says, "All this time I've been slaving for you." I mean, I've been saying these prayers. I've been doing these things that I didn't want to do in hopes that I would see a reward. Elder brothers don't have a prayer life that's about, "God, I want to bow down on my knees and just praise you because I love you for how good that you've been to me. They don't get that. And so there's this intense, finally, there's this intense pressure to pretend, to appear, to be and to appear better than what we are, to put the best foot forward, as we sometimes say. All of these things are characteristic of elder brother lostness. Is everybody like these two groups? Is everybody like these two groups? Sometimes yes and sometimes no. I think sometimes older brothers blow off steam by going to Las Vegas and having a secret life for a weekend, and nobody's allowed to tell anything to anybody, and they come home and they're back to their older brother ways. Sometimes younger brothers can be just as judgmental as older brothers. I mean, one of the facts facing folks who try to help homeless people is that homeless people repeatedly won't go to where they can find help, and it is always because the people who are there in those clinics, the people who are there in those places for the homeless, you know what? They're crazy. They're dangerous. They're crazy. I can't go there. And so someone who is really got a whole heap of real younger brother kinds of problems can still have this elder brother attitude that says those people are nuts. The biggest Pharisees I've met are people who are addicted to their own selfishness and pride and their own self-discovery, and they have nothing but Pharisaical disdain for anybody who feels differently. Perhaps the surest sign that you have something of the older brother in you, perhaps the surest sign that you've got the older brother in you is that you can't admit it. It's natural for younger brothers to think that the elder brotherliness and Christianity are just the same thing. But Jesus says they are not. In telling us this parable about the two lost sons, the prodigal God, Jesus is telling us about, is inviting us to consider that real Christianity is something different from religiosity. There's a way to know God that doesn't lead to the pathologies of moralism and judgmentalism and anxious and insecure lives, angry and joyless and condemning, refusing to join the party. No. The parable is saying that at the foundation of the world, there is just a kind of profligate spending of love. That at the foundation of the world, there is a scandalously gracious love. And that love has been expressed in the God of Israel and in Jesus Christ. The mechanisms for creation all point to relational directions. All of life is in relationship with each other. And that there is this undeserved love, this recklessly extravagant love that values others simply for their own sake. In other words, Luke is saying that there is at the base of all things a shepherd. A shepherd who loves one lost sheep. And a shepherd who is willing to risk the 99 and be really a really bad businessman. To go after one lone sheep and leave the 99 to be lost if necessary, because he has this recklessly extravagant love for one sheep. Not because that one sheep is costing him money. He's probably going to lose a lot more neglecting the 99. How many others are going to wander off while he goes recklessly after one? There's a story at the very base of all things. Jesus is saying it's like a woman who's lost a coin. It's like a woman who's lost a coin. It's kind of like Quentin, when he was real little, he had this dollar. He got this dollar. Remember this story, Amy? And he went and he spent the dollar and then had buyer's remorse. Not because he didn't want what he bought, but that he had this attachment, not to the money, not to the monetary value of the dollar that it could get him something else. He had an attachment to the dollar itself. It was the dollar that somebody gave him. And the story of a lost coin is a story that says at the base of the universe, there is something like this woman who's lost a coin and will spend a day's wages to find a day's wages. And then when she finds the coin, she throws a party that costs her more than the day's wages because she found it. In other words, she values the coin not for what it can get her, but for the thing itself. You see the parable? And this prodigal God, he loves the sons not because, boy, what great boys they are. One is completely stuck up and hates my guts and would rather be a slave in my midst than really love me. The other one is drunk, wasting his life on prostitutes, but I don't care. I'll give everything to them. I'll do anything to be just wondrously in love with them for themselves. And we look at others and we look at ourselves and we say, in Jesus Christ, we are valued because we are the beautiful creation of a lavish and prodigal God. And that's why we love. That's why we love. And that's why all the rules do matter, because they help us love. And that is different than what the world now is calling religion. What we used to call religiosity. It's different. Profoundly so. Oh, pray, go tell. Go and receive and tell as we stand and sing.